Act as if it has already happened. Chapter 3. Relationships. Yourself, family, friends, romance, community, four-legged creatures. I'm sure I'm not the only person living alone who occasionally wonders, if I fell down a manhole, how long it would take anyone to notice I'd disappeared. Ridiculous, really. But not a bad litmus test to see how connected or not you are to others, or feel you are. We all want to be loved and noticed and missed in the manhole scenario. But when you live alone, your solar system of relationships is different to other people's. It shifts more, with some relationships coming into the foreground as others recede, and they're not always the ones you expect. You realize the importance of friends and relatives, not least as a safety net, when sometimes they are all that lies between you and the drop below. I feel like a pendulum, swinging backwards and forwards between my love of solitude and the pull towards companionship, love, laughter, and the occasional intimate touch. Ironically, the skills that make us good at living alone also make us great to be around. Research has clearly shown that people who live alone are more sociable than those who live with other people. As Albert Guinan said, people who cannot bear to be alone are generally the worst company. Relationships tend to be magnifiers of emotions. Being alone has made me more discerning than ever about who plays a role in my life. By that, I don't mean to imply that someone is lucky to be my friend. What I do mean is that anyone who makes me feel bad and doubt myself does not belong in my oh-so-precious life. Relationships ranked in order of importance for those who live alone. 1. Yourself. 2. Family. 3. Friends. 4. Romance. 5. Your village. Your task is not to seek love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you've built against it. Rumi. 1. Yourself. It's the most important relationship in the world, the one you have with yourself. You're the one. When you live alone, it's crucial that you like what you see when you look in the mirror. Not your physical body, but your spirit and who you are. What your eyes say about you. Imagine meeting someone you immediately feel a connection with. Someone who completely gets your fears and dreams. Someone who's funny and great company and inspirational. A person you'd like to spend time with. It's you. Until you love that person, and it is until, not unless, nothing else will fall into place. Like yourself and you'll never be lonely. It's also a prerequisite for anyone else to love you back. They say that the entire sum of existence is the magic of being needed by just one person. Sometimes that person needs to be you. The way to be happy is to develop an unshakable sense of self-worth. It's easier said than done, as most of us judge ourselves very harshly. Rate yourself from 1 to 10, with 10 as complete acceptance and self-belief, and 1 as self-rejection. What's your number? You've got to push yourself up that scale because low self-esteem can bleed into all your relationships. The self-help industry makes millions from women who are dissatisfied with themselves. Change the script from "there are lots of things I'd change about myself, plus a few good bits," to "I am basically good and there are a few bits I'm working on." If you don't like yourself, no one else will. I love Suze Orman's joyous comment, "I date myself." Once you have that confidence and power, no one can take it away from you. There's a line in Leanne Moriarty's What Alice Forgot that jumped out at me. It's not actually possible for a dried apricot to shine, so plump yourself up. So far, so predictable. Yep, I can hear you thinking, no shit, Sherlock. But how exactly do you go about liking yourself more and acquiring that self-confidence that leads to greater self-esteem and self-worth? Try these on for size. A. Be a friend to yourself. The conversations you have in your head are the most powerful you'll ever have. We have 50,000 thoughts a day, so make sure they're kind ones. We're all familiar with the negative dialogue that can run around inside our heads. Imagine if you spoke to a friend that way. The friendship wouldn't last long. So speak to yourself as a good friend would, or an alter ego. Give her a name if you want, and feel the shift straight away. If you have the capacity to love someone else, you have the capacity to love yourself. Christopher Germer expressed it perfectly. A moment of self-compassion can change your entire day. A string of such moments can change the course of your life. B. Don't be so hard on yourself. We set ourselves ridiculously high expectations and then beat ourselves up when we don't meet them. Imagine you're a show jumper. Get off your horse, go around the course and lower the height of all the jumps. Doesn't that feel better? This is not about dumbing down, but about being realistic. Don't get dragged down by the anchor of self-blame or self-doubt. Replace your mile-long to-do list with a done list and watch your levels of satisfaction rise. Living alone already gives you a head start in the productivity stakes, and each notch you make towards your goals will increase your sense of self-worth exponentially, so don't set the bar too high. It is not an expectation to live up to, as much as a possibility to live into. C. Keep a self-esteem scrapbook. I keep a scrapbook filled with the positive letters, cards and emails that friends and readers have sent. These include thank you notes and supportive letters when my marriage ended, through to scraps of paper when my book club girls wrote down three adjectives that captured each of our personalities. On grey days, when colour is rationed and I feel being alone is a euphemism for being flawed, it's amazing what a boost it is to read them. On the first page, I have written a list of positive things about myself. As someone who's instinctively self-deprecating, that was not an easy task. Write your own and read them out aloud, or email them to yourself. If a positive mantra works for you, add that in too. Set your life on fire. Seek those who fan the flames. Rumi. D. Hold your defining image. Imagine how you'd look at your happiest. An image that captures your inner essence. A reflection of how you want to see yourself. Not distorted by the perceptions of others, like in a fairground house of mirrors. It could be a photograph of you laughing with friends, or walking along a beach, or looking out to sea. It could be a real photo, or just an image in your head. But it should help remind you of the great soul you are, especially on dark days when you might be walking in tar and feeling emotionally mugged. E. Identify the essence of you. When you live alone, you are given a wonderful opportunity to explore who you are and what you're made of. Anneli Rufus, in her book Unworthy, explores how to dismantle some self-esteem booby traps. Your post-self-loathing self is not some total stranger. He or she is you, the true you found again. We might not find our post-self-loathing selves in magazines, waving to us from fashion spreads, but we can hear our true languages in books, films, pictures, nature, music, laughter, wherever real or pretend people are. Make it a game, a sacred secret game. What speaks to you? Names, colours, landscapes, lines of dialogue. Each is a starting point. Each is a tiny light. Again, if it helps, keep a scrapbook, digital or physical, of images that give you a visceral response and capture the wonderful things that make up you. Your Jane-ness, or Kate-ness, or Sarah-ness. Maybe give yourself a trademark or two that captures it. Perhaps always wearing a flower in your hair, a slash of red lipstick, holding a special dinner party on the same date every year, or wearing unique jewellery. F. Ditch regrets and blame. You choose to be Velcro or Teflon. You can attract and keep hold of worries, or just let them slip off you. We all have them. Regrets, blame, misgivings, but they serve no purpose in our lives. They throw hooks into us and try to pull us back. So unhitch yourself, whip off your regrets and blame t-shirt, and take a step forwards and accept full responsibility for your life. Even if you feel strongly that someone has wronged you, you are responsible for your reactions and your response. Don't look backwards, only forwards, and feel the lightness descend and the sun sleep like an angel on your back. As Suze Orman said, we are free to move forward only when we remove the emotional shackles of regret. G. Acquire a new skill. Try something you've never tried before. Just learn one new thing a year. A language, boxing, opera appreciation, salsa dancing. I'm having a crack at calligraphy, hardly the wisest choice for the least patient of people, but it's amazing how good it makes me feel. And with YouTube, you have no excuse. You can learn absolutely everything on YouTube. And I mean everything. H. Set yourself a goal and accomplish it. You can do it. Whether it's losing 5 kilograms, walking 10,000 steps a day for a month, eating 5 portions of fruit and vegetables every day, or getting a new job, set yourself a goal and then kick it into touch. This is a 100% guaranteed way to have you high-fiving your reflection. I. Celebrate your birthday. A few years ago, I had a sad panda birthday. No one remembered it, not even my children. I found myself telling people in shops just to hear the words happy birthday. It was pretty desperate, but never again. Now I have a 2-pronged plan of attack. 1. I invest in a treat day by myself. A spa, movie, my favorite restaurant for lunch. Just doing something lovely, including buying myself flowers and a present. 2. I have friends over for dinner on or near the date, telling them that it is my birthday. No need for gifts. I have done this for the last couple of years and the day has been good. The trick is to plan, not leave to chance. A cautionary note. Self-esteem or self-absorption? Keep an eye out to ensure that your positive self-keeping doesn't teeter into self-absorption or dreary narcissism. Too much focus on yourself and ongoing, over-earnest self-improvement can make you boring, so keep it in perspective. On the other hand, remember that doing something for yourself isn't necessarily selfish. In Mandarin, the word selfish has 2 translations, doing something greedy and doing something that benefits yourself. We don't have that generous distinction in English, so don't feel guilty. Be thine own palace, or the world's thy jail. John Donne. 2. Family. I am in a tight braid of 3 with my 2 children, but have no other immediate family left, so I find it sad when people don't make an effort with their relatives. You are so lucky to have them. We're all strands within some sort of a family knot, however loose or dysfunctional, and of course there will be ups and downs. I plead guilty as I hadn't spoken to my sister for 1 year before she died, something I regret and have to live with. So if you are lucky enough to have siblings and close relatives, make an effort to find common ground. In recent years, I've become closer to my cousins in South Africa. Cousins is a great relationship. You are usually similar in age but are tied by blood. So closer than just friends. It is possible, even probable, that some of your relations will feel it is sad that you live alone and pity you. While you must be true to yourself, make an effort to show them your best face. Be a poster girl for the rest of us and demonstrate the positive aspects of your solo life. Don't let them feel sorry for you. You want positive interactions, not concerned, are you okay, conversations on a loop. When your parents die, you feel more alone than ever. You can initially surrender yourself to the grief, but after a while, you just have to sit alongside it. That said, not a day goes by when I don't think of my mother and father, and when their voices come back to me, winnowed from memory, my chest thickens involuntarily. On Mother's Day, British comedian Sarah Millican posted this on Facebook and had the most overwhelming response. Hugs to all of those who find Mother's Day a struggle. Whether you don't get on, she's no longer here, or whatever your story, I'm sending love. You nailed it, Sarah. I regret not having asked my parents more about their childhoods and courtship, the family tree and special memories. Do not follow my example. As I get older, I grow more interested in ancestry. Sometimes the past lays down markers for the future. Learning more about your family can give you a powerful understanding of why you think and feel the way you do. Of course families are messy and don't always work out the way you'd like. A close relative of my ex-husband rejected outright my overtures of friendship after our divorce. I was hurt, but I had tried, and have now just let it go. The right people tend to come into your life at the right time, so why bother feeding the hand that bites you? Be kind whenever possible. It is always possible. Tenzin Gyatso, 14th Dalai Lama. 3. friends. When I looked up the word alone in my laptop's thesaurus, one of the definitions was, Klein felt terribly alone. Lonely, isolated, solitary, deserted, abandoned, forsaken, forlorn, friendless. Antonyms, loved, wanted, among friends. It's interesting that the opposite of alone, well, at least in Klein's case, is defined as among friends. I spend a lot of time alone, but never feel friendless, because I know an army of allies have my back. Friends are a gift you give yourself, and when you live alone, they get pushed higher up your personal totem pole of relationships. You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with, so make sure they reflect who you want to be. Be discerning. Friends are your safety net, your sounding board, your social life, a source of happiness, and the underpinners of your self-worth. Friendships are like gardens. They need to be tended and cared for to thrive. But they also need to be weeded. So if you have friends who do not make you feel good about yourself, grab some pesticide. Sometimes we outgrow people. We learn and expand. Our attitudes and circumstances shift. And sometimes we just don't have much in common anymore. I'm not as close to some old friends as to people I've met within the last year, simply because at this point our Venn diagrams intersect. Friendships naturally ebb and flow with a few constants we can count on. Some frenemies like to think they're helping you, but their negativity can have a disproportionate impact. An unkind word or negative passo-aggresso comment can be a spear to the guts. I was recently hurt by a friend's thoughtless personal comments. He assumed he was being helpful, and I called him out on it. Our friendship is definitely bruised, possibly finished, but I'm glad I stood my ground. Sometimes people need to be told when they have crossed the line. What you permit, you endorse, and you should not put up with friends who think along the same lines as Gore Vidal. Whenever a friend succeeds, a little something in me dies. Getting divorced or being widowed throws friendships into sharp relief. Shorn of the status of being married, most women, myself included, find that some friends distance themselves, consciously or not. You can almost hear the tectonic plates of friendship shifting and grinding as your social status is recalibrated. Sometimes you have to spell out to your friends that you'd like to be included in social events when their mental checklist of invitees doesn't seem to extend beyond couples. A married friend recently was rabbiting on about her hectic social weekend. It came as a surprise when I told her I hadn't spoken to anyone for 48 hours. Friends might feel sympathy for your situation, but struggle to show empathy. Empathy takes work. Empathy beats sympathy. Sympathy reacts to the force it encounters, clicking and clacking, backwards and forwards, like the silver balls in a Newton's cradle. Authentic friends empathize. They walk in your shoes. They stand alongside you, and they will march into battle with you. As Francis Bacon put it, the worst solitude is to be destitute of sincere friendship. Sincere friends are empathetic friends. Ways to maintain momentum in friendships. Write a list to all of your friends and acquaintances. Prioritize those you need to pay more attention to. Try to send regular emails and even the occasional handwritten letter to friends who live far away. I try to write one email every quarter and cut and paste it to personalize each one. Takes a long time, but it's worth it. When someone is having a tough time, especially if they've stuffed up, reach out and let them know you have their back. They will never forget it. Put yourself on the mailing list of theatres and galleries to be the first to know when an event is coming up. When you see something you like the look of, call a few friends to check dates and then book tickets. Everyone will be so happy that you did. Every summer I book several tickets to an open-air cinema and then throw open the invitation to my friends. It is always a great success. I enjoy cooking and try to have friends round for supper once a month. I theme the meal around a particular type of cuisine. We've had Malaysian, Persian, Korean, and more. Go exploring! I love to explore different parts of my own city, especially the ethnic neighborhoods. Sometimes I take friends on mini tours. I have another exploring friend, and finding the secret places right at our back door has proven to be a great way to bring us closer. When a friend comes to you with a problem, experience has taught me that rather than blurt out your thoughts on the solution, you could imagine yourself to be like water, fluid, non-judgmental, still and reflective, and help them discover the best solution themselves. The Persian mystic poet Hafiz wrote, "Troubled, then stay with me, for I am not." And the oh-so-articulate Martha Beck said that problem-solving is simply allowing someone to be quiet enough to hear their true self. If you have friends who live overseas, try to include them on a holiday itinerary. On a trip to Europe, I caught up with my oldest friend, HB, who lives in Brussels. I was only there for one night, but it felt so good just to blow on the embers of our friendship. This is part of the email she sent me afterwards. Just too tantalizing to have you there and then to have to say goodbye. But as I said, I am always there, you are always there, even if we are on the other side of the world. Some bonds transgress time and space. Call it love. Making new friends. It will come as no surprise that studies have shown people who live alone are more socially engaged than couples. One happily married friend freely admits she's not hiring new friends. I admire her honesty and chutzpah, but I'm uncertain she'd feel the same if she were alone. We have to make an effort. I am not particularly on the lookout for new friends either, but as my time living alone has stretched from months to years, I have found myself forging new friendships in lots of different places. At a French conversation class, working at a charity, with a neighbour opposite, and taking the dog for a walk around the block, our leads became entwined. Many of my new friends also happen to live alone. It's good to have a posse of positive fellow singletons who provide ballast, and you might take the opportunity to redesign your inner circle. The point is that if you want to make new friends, and I would recommend it, then you have to get out there. Meetup.com is another great place to start. When things go wrong. You learn to have a pretty thick skin, don't you? I'm getting better at being on the pointy end of criticism, but with no one to download to, it still stings. I try to be armadillo woman and not let it pierce me. One of my most surprising disappointments was when some friends pretty much ignored me after I got divorced and started living alone. It was as if I'd been struck off a secret social register. Certainly my divorce had unsettled friends who knew their relationships were in even worse shape than mine. Grown women made me feel like Typhoid Mary. You might also learn that people who need people feel threatened by people who don't. Be strong. These friends have not earned a place in your life. I hate arguing with friends and do my best to avoid it, but sometimes it happens. Many quarrels are the results of a misunderstanding, or if one person feels no one is listening. It comes down to self-validation. Your adversary needs to know that you see them, you hear them, and that what they say matters to you. Be patient and consider them an EGR, extra grace required. Remember that whenever you point at someone, three fingers are pointing back at you. Do you want to be right or do you want peace? Don't let things fester. Try to resolve problems, but if you can't, walk away. Your life is too precious to have negative energy in it or to get trapped down an emotional cul-de-sac. Slip out of the relationship like a snake leaving its skin behind. Sometimes people around you will behave badly. I have learned it's not worth wasting your energy responding to, criticizing, or commenting on their behavior. Reframe their actions as a lesson in how not to behave. Write down everything you want to say to them, pouring out your wounded heart, then tear it up and move on. If you hit back, judge, and bitch about them, then you become what they are. The author Byron Katie said, "I am what I believe you to be in the moment that I believe it." Maybe you've been guilty of the same behavior. If so, rise above. One true friend adds more to our happiness than 1,000 enemies add to our unhappiness. Marie von Ebner-Essenbach. A final thought on friends. There comes a point in your life when you realize who matters, who never did, who won't anymore, and who always will. So don't worry about people from your past. There's a reason why they didn't make it to your future. Adam Lindsay Gordon. 4. Romance. The love between my ex-husband and me disappeared when we weren't looking. It's not easy to have a broken heart, un cœur brisé, or shattered heart, as the French say. But I learn you simply have to let old stuff go and not look back. You don't want to be the one with a heart full of splinters, even when the person you loved and trusted turns out not to be the person you thought they were. That person no longer exists, and it helps. Forgiveness is not about them, it's about you. If you don't forgive someone, your stored hatred and angst does you much more harm than it does them. What's worse is that it binds you to them. When you forgive someone, you release their power over you. In their book From Aging to Saging, authors Zalman Sakhter-Shalomi and Ronald Miller have these fantastically resonating words about forgiveness. When I refuse to forgive someone who has wronged me, I mobilize my own inner criminal justice system to punish the offender. As judge and jury, I sentence the person to a long prison term without pardon and incarcerate him in a prison that I construct from bricks and mortar of a hardened heart. Now, as jailer and warden, I must spend as much time in prison as the person I am guarding. All the energy that I put into maintaining the prison system comes out of my energy budget. From this point of view, bearing a grudge is very costly because long-held feelings of anger, resentment, and fear drain my energy and imprison my vitality and creativity. Holding on to anger is like taking poison and hoping someone else will die. It's choose your organs. Steve Harvey nailed it when he said, "You can be happy or you can be right," although I can't help but laugh with a friend whose deeply flawed ex is called Rick, or Rick with a silent P, as she still refers to him. Together Alone. I was as surprised as anyone to learn that love can spit, and that when it does, it spits venom in your eye. I know what it's like to tether yourself to someone, then have your heart ripped from its moorings. It bloody hurts, even if you know that you were opposing forces, you as alkaline to their acid. But you can't drag around the corpse of a dying relationship behind you. Always remember how much better off you are alone than as one of those married couples living in a vast Sahara, a veritable Gobi desert of unions. Shockingly, only 25% of married Australians describe their marriages as happy. Better to be alone than wish you were. There are many people who feel utterly alone, even though they live with someone. To be in a relationship characterized by indifference is the worst kind of aloneness. Indifference, not hate, is the opposite of love. And it is awful to see how many people feel lonely within a fractured marriage or a hobbled relationship, the tentacles of the past being the only things binding them together. If you are in this situation, I hope you can find the confidence to make a break for it. Living a life of self-determination brings freedom. You should never have to justify leaving, but you do have to justify staying. If it helps, write down everything you weren't happy with in the relationship and take comfort in the fact you will never have to deal with them again. Although I now carry a fault line through my heart, I don't regret being married, but I know now that being married is not the only way to feel complete. You can feel complete alone. Do not let anyone take away your joy. It is far better to be unhappy alone than unhappy with someone. So far, Marilyn Monroe. We all have a better guide in ourselves, if we would attend to it, than any other person can be. Jane Austen. Accepting being single. How the world misses Nora Ephron's wit and wisdom. It seemed to me that the desire to get married, which I regret to say I believe is fundamental and primal in women, is followed almost immediately by an equally fundamental and primal urge, which is to be single again. On the whole, living alone and being single are pretty good companions, though it's better if they are conscious choice, not a forced compromise. In her book Living Solo, Lancy Goldner distinguishes between being circumstantially single and emotionally single. The former means that life didn't necessarily turn out as you expected, and you remain single but don't dwell on it. That's where I am. It has been a while since I wrote Heart equals stolen in my diary. Being emotionally single, on the other hand, means you feel a keen sense of despair and sadness about being single, accompanied by a damaging belief that you're not entitled to get what you want out of life. This can be quite debilitating, and you might require professional help to shift gears. Feeling good about yourself as a single person does not always come easily or naturally. Society has dictated that we act in a certain way, catch the golden ring of marriage, or accept the badge of failure. If you were wanted and desirable, you wouldn't be alone, would you? Luckily, I have enough self-worth not to subscribe to these thoughts, but I face up to the real possibility that I might be alone forever. It is a common story. Among my divorce friends, every ex-husband has repartnered, and quickly, but the women have not. The odds are not stacked in our favour. Once you have been alone for a while and things begin to fall into place, you start to appreciate it more and more and wonder if the benefits of being alone, doing what I like, when I like, where I like, how I like, and with whom I please, could ever be relinquished. It ain't what they call you, it's what you answer to. W.C. Fields. Romance. Do you want it? You'll meet someone when you least expect it. If one more person tells me that, I will bop them on the nose. Just watch me. Romance seems to be the happy ending everyone else wants for me. I'm not sure Eat, Pray, Love would have reached the same dizzy heights of success if it had been Eat, Pray, Make New Friends. You need to decide if you are ready or willing to embark on a new relationship. If you are, you will positively exude the I'm up for it vibe, which will be picked up like iron filings on a magnet by the right person who will be in a similar frame of mind. That's how it works. I love being alone, perhaps a bit too much, and am wary about putting myself in a position where I can be hurt again. Or be seen naked, come to that. My, what big underpants you have, Jane. Right now, my heart is silted up, curled up like a cello end of a fern. But I know I must be careful not to shut myself down to the possibility, and of course it can be wonderful to meet someone who respects the preciousness and trust inherent in an intimate relationship and who wants you to grow and reach your full potential. And I'd love to move my sex life on from its current Halley's Comet trajectory, making a fuzzy appearance once every 75 years, although there is a comfort in celibacy. In his wonderful essay, Going It Alone, Fenton Johnson calls it a joyous turning inwards and quotes the notoriously celibate Emily Dickinson, inebriate of air I am and a debauchee of Jew. You start to wonder if it's sex you miss or the before and after bits. Meanwhile, I am happily indulging my sensual side with candlelit baths, massages, and zillion thread count sheets. There is an audible crackle when I get into bed. And, how lucky am I, a friend has given me a boyfriend pillow in the shape of a man's headless torso, wearing, bewilderingly, a crisp blue button-down business shirt. The idea is that you snuggle up in the crook of his arm and fall asleep. I mention this because I think it is funny, but I'm aware it hardly captures the spirit of this book. Loving being alone, not getting comfort from an ersatz one-armed headless lover in a business shirt. Ho-hum. Of course I'd love my heart to catch and feel a shockwave run through me like a conger eel, or meet someone as thoughtful and romantic as my English father, who placed a sheet of corrugated iron outside my parents' bedroom window, so my Kiwi mother was reminded of the sound of home when it rained. And who wouldn't have wanted to be on the receiving end of Tom Fletcher's wedding speech? McFly, Google it. Several divorced women I know have found love quite unexpectedly and very happily with another woman, Elizabeth Gilbert included, apparently. Good for them. I am now at a place where my happiness is not contingent on meeting someone. A relationship is optional, friendships are not. A man, or possibly a woman, is the icing, not the cake. I cannot imagine compromising or relinquishing my independence. But everyone is different, and for some, a mate is high on their list. What do I want? As I get older, and this is exacerbated the longer I live alone, I am less willing to compromise in any aspect of my life, and that includes dating. I have a fully functioning dickhead radar, and I'm well aware that the length of my must-have list for a prospective beau is in inverse proportion to my chances of meeting him. Top of the list is a curious mind and wit, followed by a love of travel and walking in the rain, knowing what an okapi is, how to make spaghetti carbonara, no cream, appreciating that supermarkets in other countries are as interesting as museums, having a penchant for spicy noodles, being solvent, knowing how to spell, or at the minimum knowing where to put an apostrophe, or spell apostrophe if it comes to that. Doesn't move his lips when he reads, that's a deal breaker. And being young enough not to be able to braid his nasal hair. Am I asking too much? Single is not a status. It is a word that best describes a person who is strong enough to live and enjoy life without depending on others. Author unknown. Parsley, peaches or pizza. Being realistic. The chances of meeting someone as you get older are much higher if you're a man than a woman. The Japanese have coined a word for this. Single women over 30 are called pasuri or parsley because that is the only thing left on the plate. Depressing, huh? Even if I was brave enough to dip a toe in the dating pool, I don't care to be rejected. As Dieter von Teese said, you can be the ripest, juiciest peach in the world and there's still going to be someone who hates peaches. At the moment, I am happily adopting the que sera sera, whatever will be, philosophy. But I am well aware that if and when I am ready to meet someone, they're not going to knock at my door as I sit in my navy blue Land's End nighty, watching Netflix and eating Diavola pizza. I know I will need to get out there and join that gym, do that evening class, volunteer for that thing, say yes to that invitation I'd rather decline, and so on. But you can only do so much. The best relationships are effortless and are born from friendship, which is why internet dating seems counterintuitive. But you can't argue with the numbers, and a huge percentage of relationships start online. The stigma about finding love this way has disappeared, but I fear my emotional skin is too thin and I haven't got enough patience or frog-kissing courage in me to take the plunge. I can't see myself swiping right anytime soon. Right now, I am happily living moth. Man of the house free. It is better to be single with high standards than in a relationship settling for less. Author unknown. Of course, there is always a possibility of meeting a stranger at an event you have an interest in. A concert, a talk, a foodie dinner, or an evening class. Try accepting every single invitation for a month or two. My failures at connecting in these circumstances outweigh my successes, but you never know who you might meet. If you're out of practice making new connections, you could do worse than take a leaf from Dale Carnegie's classic bestseller, 30 million copies sold, How to Win Friends and Influence People. In a nutshell, be interested in people, smile, remember their name, the sweetest and most important sound in any language, be a good listener, talk about their interests and make them feel important. Sounds like good advice. Maybe I am a quirky alone, an interesting, if slightly mannered term coined by journalist Sasha Kagan to identify people who are all for romance, but would rather be happily single than in a relationship just for the sake of it. In her book, Quirky Alone, A Manifesto for Uncompromising Romantics, she talks about the tyranny of coupledom, and I agree with her. Looking at couples from my side of the fence, that life seems oppressive. Maybe I'm growing more cynical. But the thought of someone saying, you complete me, makes me shudder in a way I usually reserve for mime artists. I am single, but somehow making a thing of it feels a wee bit the lady doth protest too much, methinks. For example, wearing a single ring. On a website selling these, they suggest, my life is fabulous as it is, yet I am open to the possibilities. The ring is an empowering reminder to the members that they are already complete. I prefer the De Beers buy yourself a right-hand diamond ring concept. The left hand says we, the right hand says me. 5. Your village. I have never made much of an effort to talk to strangers. I was always in a rush, running from work to the children and just being busy. That has changed over the time I've been living alone. You learn to appreciate a smile or a kind word from a neighbour, shop assistant or cafe owner. Sometimes it's just enough to quench a thirst for connection. It reminds me of the Sufi story about a man who says, "Master, I have discovered the answer. Knock and the door will be opened to you." The master replies, "Who said the door was closed?" When we feel alone, we still have an asteroid belt of different communities orbiting us. Family, friends, and work colleagues are the closest, but don't dismiss the neighborhood. It might sound contrived, but I have set myself a challenge to make a new local friend by the end of the year. I have a dog park nearby, full of sociable neighbors, which is a good place to start. Here I have to confess that I recently entered Rory into the local dog show, where he won the fancy dress class, dressed in a homemade Sherlock Holmes outfit, Sherlock Bones. It was a one-off, and I think might be God's way of telling me I had too much time on my hands. That said, I have arranged to have a glass of wine with the lovely woman who sponsored the show and who also happens to live alone, so there's my new local friend quota successfully met already. In Australia, about 40% of us know our neighbours. It's not only nice to have someone know your name, but there will be also times when you need them for something important, an accident, illness, or not so important, like moving a heavy piece of furniture. On a more philosophical note, there is something about connecting to your broader community that evokes the spirit of Ubuntu, the South African belief in a universal bond of sharing that connects us all. There is no literal translation, but it means, "I am because we are." The point is that you might be alone as you read this, but you are never really alone. You are part of humanity. A final thought. Two legs or four. People who don't live alone patronizingly assume that a pet can be a substitute for a human companion and a certain cure for loneliness. Wrong on both counts. I have a dog, and when he is away, the heart of the house seems empty. But that said, Rory is a dog, a pet. I love the fact that he welcomes me ecstatically, forces me to go for walks, and occasionally actually smiles at me. But he is not a replacement for a two-legged friend, nor is he my fur friend or my fur child. We don't have philosophical discussions about Nietzsche, watch Game of Thrones, or share dinner and a bottle of red. A companion, absolutely. A substitute for a human relationship, no. You can't stay in your corner of the forest waiting for people to come to you. You have to go to them sometimes. Author unknown. Takeaways. Put yourself at the top of the list and learn to like who you are. Make an effort with your family. Look after your friends, but don't be afraid to weed and make new ones. Move on from past relationships and decide if you're ready for romance. Cultivate your village. Chapter 4. Staying Healthy. Writing a personal health plan, mindset, nutrition, physical and mental health. Losing weight, solo health issues, and how to avoid them. Your health is everything. You can't seize your days if you ignore your body. Living alone bumps health up to the very, very top of the soloist priority list. The harsh reality is that there is no one at hand to help you if things start deteriorating or go badly wrong. You can and should make sure you have a veritable Greek chorus of health professionals behind you, including a Goldilocks of a GP, not too old, not too young, just right, whom you respect and trust, and a group of friends you can call on. But prevention is better than cure, and you are your own safety net. Your friends aren't interested in your minor or even major health problems. You have to take responsibility for your health. If I ever find myself becoming complacent, I only need to remember the correlation between health and independence. The greatest wealth is health. Virgil. You are your own safety net. In Living Solo, Nancy Goldner talks of climbing the age ladder solo. I'd rather be climbing it two steps at a time than hauling myself up the rungs like James Caan in Misery. Helen Gurley Brown called marriage insurance for the worst years of your life. I don't have that insurance, and I'm determined, have to be, to be as independent as possible for as long as possible. I want to ensure I get to do all the things I want to do and that no one has to wipe my bottom until I'm good and ready. Actually, I never want anyone to have to wipe my bottom. I find that a mighty incentive. There is also a financial motive. Doctors and illnesses are expensive. Medicare data shows that 30% of all the money you spend on healthcare will be spent in the last 6 months of your life. You might have noticed that I bang on like a barn door about the importance of self-reliance. When it comes to health, self-reliance also means taking back control and sovereignty of our bodies in a world that is set up to help us fail, with transport, not feet, that moves us effortlessly from A to B, conveniently processed and packaged food, and entertainment that is spoon-fed to our laptops. This chapter will show you ways to call your own shots. It's in two parts. The first, about writing a personal health plan. The second, looking at how we can defy the accepted health implications of living alone. We're good at pushing back. Part 1. A personal health plan. Take a cold, hard look at yourself health-wise. To do this objectively, get a top-to-toe professional health check, either from your GP or a specialized private service. That will provide an empirical benchmark measurement and is the perfect point to confront yourself if you need to fix something. Assess yourself honestly. Most of us take our health for granted like an old car, metaphorically spraying a coat of paint over it rather than looking under the bonnet and consciously poking about. To quote W.H. Auden, death is the sound of distant thunder at a picnic. For many years, I managed to disassociate my actions and lifestyle from their impact on my body, but recently I've begun to feel a little out of kilter and disconnected to it. Not surprisingly, there came a time when my body said, "If you don't give a damn about me, I won't give a damn about you." Little things started to twinge, spasm, snap, dangle, leak, grow, flop, or drop off. Our bodies are truly incredible machines, rigged with all sorts of early warning systems, such as changes in blood pressure, cholesterol levels, weight, and BMI. Your body is constantly giving you messages. It is your job to listen. "I'm tired of being tired. I ache not to ache. I want to feel what it feels like to feel great. I've been running with scissors for so long, I think I've forgotten. Feeling average is normal. I want to give my body the chance to see what it's capable of if I work with it rather than against it." Our bodies give us a second chance. Our bodies are amazing biological machines, not least because they possess an enormous, astonishing, and persistent capacity to heal and repair. They are amazingly forgiving. Just for starters, they produce 2.5 million new red blood cells every second. Human bodies are elastic bands wanting to get back into shape. There comes a point when you can't go on borrowing against the future, but it is never, ever too late to pick up healthy habits. In a disordered mind, as in a disordered body, soundness of health is impossible. Cicero. Writing my health plan. As an organized, systematic person, the idea of writing a health plan appealed. But not being a naturally svelte, kale-munching Bikram hot yoga chick, more bison than gazelle, I had to come up with a plan that was realistic enough to really, honestly, truly integrate into my life, something sustainable. Simple things work, so there are only 5 parts to my plan. 1, mindset. 2, nutrition. 3, physical health. 4, mental health. 5, facts and figures. Some people like to write a physical plan, while others are happy keeping the information in their heads. You will instinctively know what's right for you if you listen. Naturally, your plan will evolve and change over time, depending on what works. 1. Mindset. Head first, then body. It's important to get your head into the right space as you approach your health strategy. Our brains are the most powerful organs in our bodies, and we need to harness that power. What do you think would help shift your mind towards embracing a healthier lifestyle and integrating it into a routine? What motivates you? What is holding you back? And how will you overcome the inevitable speed bumps? It's important to identify them so you know what to do when the going gets tough, which it has a habit of doing. Here are some things that have helped me. Find images that motivate you. It could be a picture of someone you admire, Brienne of Tarth, or your before photo as the wallpaper on your phone, or where you'd like to be in a year, or simply that beach you've always dreamt about. Find a health mantra or design your own. Fitness is 100% mental. Your body won't go where your mind doesn't push it. Nothing is impossible. The word itself says, I'm possible. You are entirely up to you. Make your body, make your life, make yourself. Every journey begins with a single step. No matter how slow you go, you are still lapping everyone who's sitting on the sofa. I am powerful. I am in control. Success does not come to you. You go to it. Energy flows where attention goes. Motivation gets you started. Habit keeps you going. Make one healthy choice, then another. Exercise to be fit, not skinny. Eat to nourish your body and always ignore the haters and doubters. You are worth more than you realize. Today is the chance to change yourself for the better. Simply do it. I'm working on myself, for myself, by myself. Note to self, I'm going to make you so proud. The groundwork of all happiness is health. Lee Hunt. Small things make a difference. This thought encourages me to dive in and make small changes rather than waiting for the right moment or the 1st of January to roll around with the resolution charade in tow. Be happy with a second loop round the park or a green juice instead of a ham and cheese croissant. Both will nudge the ship in the right direction. Research has shown our bodies respond rapidly and appreciate the smallest of changes. Enjoy the feeling of being in control. Knowing that I have a plan for my health gives me a feeling of confidence. It also protects me from the unsolicited advice and criticism of well-meaning friends. And isn't there a lot of it? Self-care. How you approach your health and its effect on your body is a public reflection of how much you value and care for yourself, or not. Take charge of your health. Don't treat the doctor like a repair shop. I don't have to do anything. I choose to do it. Change your language. I have to go to the gym because, or I choose to go to the gym because it makes me feel. I have to avoid wheels that breathe the size of my head because, or I choose to eat this beautiful dewy bowl of berries because it makes me feel. We are in control of what we do. No one is forcing us. Most of my life I've lived in my brain. Now it's time to live in my body. I will treat my body like a business. Everything I do, work and pleasure, requires energy. Being unhealthy is a thief of productivity. JFDI. The world rewards doers. It's just about doing stuff. Planning, thinking and writing about your health is good. Doing stuff is the bomb. Even a humble drop of water can erode a rock if it drips consistently. As Zig Ziglar said, do it, and then you will be motivated to do it. 2. Nutrition. Heather Morgan had it right when she said, every time you eat or drink, you are either feeding disease or fighting it. Eating well is simple. If you came across a poor fish swimming unhappily in a tank of dirty water, you would clean the tank and change the water immediately. Do the same for yourself. Eating nutritious food is the single most powerful thing we can do to improve our health and fire up our body's powerful self-healing properties, even more than exercise. As my enviably live midlife friend Josie puts it, it's all about what you put into your mouth. Food is by far the number one cause of preventable death and disease in the USA, and where Americans go, we tend to follow. It's an obscene fact that these days many more people will cark it from eating too much than not enough. Millions of years of healthy life are lost because of poor food choices. It's about so much more than the latest fad for clean food. Fresh, whole, unprocessed, especially plant-based foods, are repositories of prana, or life energy. Food with life force will give you energy. They say that if you eat food made by people in white coats, then that's what you can expect later in life. I'm not going to patronize you by telling you specifically what to eat. You know the drill. Eat more colors in your fruit and veggies than Joseph had in his dream coat. especially dark green leafy vegetables like silver beet, cavallonero, kale and spinach. Protein from lean meat, beans or lentils. Whole grains, good fats, nuts and seeds. And no added salt. The trick is to find recipes that you really like. Even if the only thing you do is stop eating crap, it will have a profound effect on your body. God knows I have played artery roulette with abandon for years, but now feel a compulsion to stop. Good nutrition starts in the supermarket, specifically the outer rim of the supermarket, but then you know that too. You also know your personal nutritional bêtes noires better than anyone. Too much sugar, takeaway dinners, leftovers for breakfast, big portions, or cozying up to the wine witch, a wonderful phrase coined by the Soberistas blog. It's up to you to find replacements that fit the task. Build a file, physical or digital, of healthy recipes that you like. Split into breakfast, lunch, dinner and snacks, so that you always have inspiration at hand. In my folder, the breakfast section has juice and smoothie recipes. Chop the fruit the night before and put in the blender in the fridge for the morning, plus savory muffins and healthy toppings for half a whole grain English muffin. Avocado is a firm favorite at breakfast, especially with Vegemite. I know. Also, Greek yogurt with berries and oats. Lunch is mostly vegetarian soups, salads, and wraps. I'm going through a vegetable fritter phase for supper at the moment. Any vegetables that wanders into the kitchen is in danger of being grated, mixed with an egg, shallot, chili, flour, herbs, and spices, and being pan-fried in a spritz of oil. Delicious, crispy, and healthy. Other regular suppers include a chickpea curry for one, or a baked sweet potato, start in the microwave, finish in the oven, with homemade, fat-free, refried black beans, avocado, and yogurt. Snacks that don't avoid us include roasted pumpkin seeds with sriracha and lime, crunchy oven-baked duck and chickpeas, and homemade microwave popcorn with smoked paprika, or a banana with a little almond butter on it. Of course, the magic combination is good food plus exercise. When diet is wrong, medicine is of no use. When diet is correct, medicine is of no need. Ayurvedic proverb. 3. Physical health. The truth bomb is that physical exercise isn't optional. Ouch. I try not to think of exercise as exercise with a capital E, but just something we humans are designed to do naturally. Neanderthal women weren't waiting at home, sweeping the cave and knocking up Brontosaurus burgers. They were out there hunting with the best of them. I'm afraid the cliched use it or lose it is true. In their book, Younger Next Year for Women, Chris Cowley and Henry S. Lodge cannot emphasize this point enough. If you don't send any signals to grow, decay will win. But even a modest signal to grow, a decent workout, even a good stiff walk, will drown out the noise. Thing is, you need to tell your body it's springtime. So I try not to overthink exercise and just get on with it. The best advice is that the ideal form of exercise is the one that you'll actually do. So for me, that rules out running, mountain biking, surfing and ballroom dancing, but never say never. At least we have more choices than ever before of finding something we enjoy. Living alone gives you the time and opportunity to cast your net wide when it comes to trying new things. There are usually one-off trial classes available, so if you make a fool of yourself, you know you are not committed and don't have to ever go again. Become a scientist of your own exercise experiments and check how you feel after each one. I prefer to exercise alone. Walking is my daily exercise. I try to do 10,000 steps a day, easier now there's a pedometer on my phone. I do enjoy it, but it can become a bit monotonous, so here are some suggestions to boost its impact. Switch on your core as you set out. Pull your tummy button towards your spine. Be aware of your pelvic floor. Time your walk and try and beat it. Every 5 minutes, do some step-ups or run for 60 seconds. Make a special walk.